take time to read the book of James. We're going to be preaching our way through it in the next few weeks. James 1, 1 through 8 begins, James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect, that is, mature and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith, without any doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. This epistle written by the half-brother of Jesus, that is, one of the brothers and sisters of Jesus who were the sons of and daughters of Mary and Joseph, whereas Jesus, being just the son of Mary, makes James a half-brother. This is one of these who became, he and his brother Jude, wrote the book of Jude, or Judas, became a believer after the resurrection, an elder in the church at Jerusalem. We read about him in the book of Acts, especially Acts 15. This man who became a great leader in the Jerusalem church writes a letter to the 12 tribes, probably meaning the church. We recall that the church was dispersed after the stoning of Stephen. We read in Acts 8, the first part of Acts 8, that because of the persecution that came against the church in Jerusalem, which was sort of touched off by the stoning of Stephen, that the early church went everywhere preaching the gospel. It was dispersed in the various parts of the world, the Mediterranean world. And not quite sure exactly to whom he's writing. This 12 tribes is probably, he's probably using this in its symbolic or figurative fulfillment in the church, as Paul does to the Galatians and does to the Hebrews. That is, that the church scattered abroad has become the 12 tribes of Israel, which is scattered throughout the Mediterranean world. He's writing to these about temptations and the wisdom needed to endure temptation. First, the theme of this part of James is this, that endurance of temptations and trials is the way of life. You got that? That's the first point. That this thing of enduring temptations and trials, this thing of having difficulties, is just the way it is. People are surprised at that. If you followed a lot of modern theologies, you would get the impression that the Christian life is one long Sunday afternoon tea party. That once you become a Christian, everything becomes easy, the road is smooth, no more tears, no more difficulties. And that's simply not true. He starts out in verse 2 after his greeting, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. He does not say, consider it joy if you encounter various trials. He says, consider it joy when you encounter various trials. That's just the way it is. And note the paradox here. The world would not understand this at all. He says, brethren, now when things get tough, when a loved one dies, or you lose your last friend, or you lose your job, or you've worked with somebody trying to win them to the Lord for weeks and weeks, and they turn their back on you, when your heart is broken, when friends betray you, when your kid gets kicked out of school, when things really get bad, just count it all joy. Consider it joy. You say, what? Yeah, consider it joy. Paradox. The joyful response to temptations. Well, you see, this is what the Christian life is. It's a polemic. It's a struggle, but a joyful one. That's the difference. This is the difference between a Christian life and its struggles and a non-Christian life and its struggles, because everybody has troubles. That the Christian has just about the same troubles that the non-Christian has. Sometimes more, because when a man becomes a Christian, often his heart becomes sensitive and his eye becomes open to things that he never cared about before. And so there is a real sense, I think you would agree, in which a Christian often gets his or her heart broken more often than those who do not really know what it is to have Jesus as Savior. What's the difference? For the non-Christian and the Christian alike, people die. Often I hear Christians, and I think it's a sign of a lack of good teaching and a lack of maturity. When someone dies, they say, well, don't understand this. He or she, they were good Christians. Well, they loved the Lord. They served the Lord. Or when we undergo terrible sickness or pain, perhaps an operation, or a loved one undergoes this thing. Often we say, well, now why, I don't see why I have to suffer like this, or I don't see why they have to suffer like this. Why, they love God. Why, the way they're suffering, you'd think that they were an old hardened sinner out here who was a God rejecter. Ah, but the Bible does not teach. The Bible does not teach that the Christian will have an easier time of it than the non-Christian. The Bible does not teach that the Christian will not have any trials or temptations. The Bible does not teach that the Christian road is a road without any chuck holes or bumps or blind curves. It does not teach that the Christian walk is not a walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It's not a walk through the forest of adversity. The Bible teaches, as James teaches here, the difference is that the Christian has something in his heart. He has Jesus Christ, and therefore he can view these difficulties that everyone has in a different way. That is, what does he say? Consider it joy, my brethren, when you enter various trials. And that's the difference. Everybody has tears. But God in Jesus Christ gives us a reason to smile through the tears. And to rejoice even in temptation. What is there about a trial or a temptation that would cause us to rejoice? Listen, be careful in this now. Because if we grumble in the face of trials and temptations, of difficulties that we all have, if we grumble, then this grumbling is symptomatic of a serious spiritual deficiency. Brother, if we gripe all the time, we've got problems. And I think there's something terribly wrong. If I understand the book of James and the other teachings in Scripture on this subject, I think there's something very wrong with a griping Christian. Now, I say this in all love, but I'm your preacher, and man, we might as well speak of things as they are. It gets on my nerves sometimes to hear somebody who's a Christian who has troubles, and they sound just like the non-Christian who has the same troubles. They gripe just as loud, some even louder. What does he say? Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Count it joyfully. Smile through your tears. Why? Well, we could list many reasons why we take a positive approach to temptations and trials. We see that a trial is an opportunity to develop virtues that can only come through suffering. Gold can only be refined in the fire. And there is a certain kind of growth and maturity in the Christian life that can only come in hard times. I understand, I don't know, that I have this as secondhand knowledge, but I understand that the ancient shipbuilders, at least in America, when they wanted to find to cut a tree for the main mast of a ship, they chose some wood like oak, close grain wood that would really stand the stress and the strain of the main sail. And I understand that the strain on the main sail of a ship is on the main mast of a ship in a storm, a sailing vessel is very, very, is tremendous. And they couldn't have this wood, the kind that would splinter or break easily. And they wouldn't go into the forest and pick a tree, an oak tree that had stood in the middle of a forest. They would go far and wide, search far and wide to find an oak tree or the kind of ash or whatever they were using that stood by itself out in the middle of an open field where it was not shielded from the wind at all, where the full force of every winter's wind had blown upon it, and they found that the tree that had stood out by itself, had, you follow me, not sheltered by the other trees, not having the wind broken year after year as it was growing and maturing by the wind, that this tree was stronger than a tree of the same size taken from the middle of the woods where it would be spared from the constant buffeting of the wind, where much of the force would have been alleviated by the trees around it. And that's the way it is, you know. There are some kinds of toughness and maturity and strength in the Christian life that can only come in hard times. I tell you, an eye that's never been washed by real tears is a blind eye. Until we've learned, until we've had our hearts broken, I don't think we really see things as they are. And we certainly do not enter into the discipleship of one called Jesus, in the spirit of Jesus, until we become, to a degree, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, because that's who he was. We count it a joy to enter into temptations because, you know, I think it helps us along for heaven. Did you ever notice how when things really get bad, that this world doesn't look quite as good as it does at other times? I think there would never be any real longing for heaven on our part unless we had some things that would really cause us to cut the ties from this world. And we're just human and weak in this, but I think we all admit that. Haven't you ever come to a place where you say, well, Lord, I'd just soon go home. I'd just soon forget the whole mess down here and go on, cross over Jordan to the promised land because things aren't so good here. So I think that we ought to joyfully approach difficulties in life because it helps us to long for heaven. It helps us to be Christ-like. We suffer, he suffers. And I think, last of all, it helps us to learn to trust in God. I tell you, a lot of us, and we're weak in this, unless we might as well admit it, that we never trust in God until we have to. And so James says, not if you enter temptations, not if you have difficulties, but when you have them, count it joy. When you enter into temptations, what kind of temptations? Various temptations. The King James translates it manifold temptations. A very interesting word. I would pause and dwell on it just a moment. Count it all joy, it says, when you enter into various temptations. We've given the reasons for counting it all joy. This word various, literally in the original language, means many color, many hued. It was used by the ancient Greeks to describe the rainbow. Difficulties that come in all shades, you see. And to sort of do a little take off on this, you know, the troubles seem to come in all shades, all kinds, all colors, various kinds of troubles. And you ever come to, has something ever happened to you when you said, it would only happen to me? Well, of all the dumb things that happen, of all the unusual things that happen, you know, why come it never happens to anybody else? All the crazy things that can happen always seem to happen to me. And that's exactly what this word means. Things in various colors, various shades, various kinds. Listen, the temptations that come upon us are just the kind that James says. They are various, manifold. They are many-colored. They're all kinds. And I say this because just when we think we've got life tied up in a string, just when we think we've got all the loose ends gathered up, everything's in shape, you know, something will happen that we never in the world could have prepared for. And there we go again, standing in the need of prayer. And that's the way it works, isn't it? Anyhow, and the devil's, you know, this word, as I said, was used by the ancients to describe the rainbow because it was many-colored. You know, the devil's got a rainbow and God's got one. And for every manifold temptation that the devil would try to paint us one of his colors, God can cause us to appear in one of his colors, and we can therefore count it joy when we enter into various temptations, you know. So some temptations cause us to turn red. You ever notice that? You ever make boys my face red. Some temptations embarrass us, but you know, a lot of times when things happen, we just get mad. Sometimes we get mad at God. Now, don't say you don't. Sometimes you do. You get mad at God. So in this many-colored temptations, sometimes the devil likes the first to turn red. You know, red's also, you know, I think of the red badge of courage. We might as well, if we're going to be red, might as well be a sign of courage and not of anger, hadn't it? You know, the devil sometimes likes to get us to turn blue with these many-colored temptations. Yeah, you're saying, boy, I've got the blues today. Yeah, how many of you, don't raise your hand, any of you got the blues today? Boy, I'm blue. Yeah. Well, you know, blue, if you're going to be blue, why not be God's blue? Be true blue. You know, blue is not only a sign of despair, blue is a sign of loyalty. So if you're going to be blue, be loyal, true blue. You know, the devil sometimes tries to make us yellow. You know what yellow is? That's when the devil's rainbow, that's cowardice. Yeah. You know, silence is not always golden. Sometimes it's just an off yellow. And if we're going to be yellow, we might as well be yellow in God's rainbow. Let's be radiant. See, that works. I'm not done yet. Sometimes the devil, with these many-colored temptations, tries to get us to turn purple with pride. Oh, listen, pride is a fundamental sin. All I'm saying is, if we're going to be purple, let it be a sign of nobility. Let's wear the purple. As children of the king, my father's rich in houses and lands, and he holdeth the wealth of the world in his hands. Rubies and diamonds and silver and gold, his coffers are full, he has riches untold. And I'm the child of the king. His royal blood now flows in my veins. You know, the devil, I'm about finished. You know, the devil tries to make us turn green with these manifold temptations, with envy. You know, ever notice that there's something about your neighbor's new car that makes your own nose turn green? Did you ever notice that? Strange, but I never ever figured that out. Yeah. Well, if we're going to be green, let's not have it be a sign of envy in the devil's rainbow. Why don't we count it joy when we enter these manifold temptations and let green be the sign of growth in God's rainbow? Well, that's the way it is. All kinds of temptations have all kinds of effects on us. Count it all joy, brethren, when you enter into various kinds, various colors, manifolds, various unpredictable temptations. Because, why? Knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. We've already said that there's a kind of endurance, there's a kind of spiritual toughness that only the testing of the faith can endure. The trying of your faith produces endurance. I like tough Christians. I know some Christians who are so tough. That is, you know, that nothing could run them away from the church. You can't insult them bad enough. They're not going to get their feelings hurt and leave the church. They may get their feelings hurt, but they're not going to leave. And they can't fail enough times to quit. There's some of you, now I'm not going to name any names, but I've known you for 9 years, and you're still doing jobs, and you've had, because you just, in the normal course of things, just like me, we've failed, haven't we? We've tried things and they haven't worked, but bless your hearts, you're still in there. You go, why? I tell you, you're tough. You know, I think if they ever started persecuting us, like in the first century church, and started throwing us to lions, I know of a few of us that they wouldn't eat. Anyway, knowing that the trying of your faith worketh patience, worketh endurance, this toughness, this quiet durability, which is the sign of maturity. Now, the last part of the first section we're dealing with this morning speaks about the wisdom that we need. You see, we've painted the picture of what James says about this endurance, this toughness that comes only by the endurance of these temptations. We're to count it joy when we enter into these temptations because we know that they can work to our good. It will lead to spiritual maturity. But if we're going to do this, it's going to take wisdom. I tell you, it takes a divine wisdom to know how to deal with life. That is the hard things in life. Anybody, it seems, can deal with things when things are going well. Any fool can be happy when everything is going, when the bills are paid and the kids are all healthy and your mother-in-law isn't living with, no. Anyway, anybody can be happy when everything's going right, but listen, when things are going bad, it takes wisdom. I think this is why James says, but if any of you lacks wisdom, what kind of wisdom? The wisdom that we need to joyfully approach these trials and temptations. Look at our text. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, and then he says, well, God gives to all men generously, without reproach, it will be given him. In other words, it's the doctrine of Romans 8, because we ought to enter boldly into the throne of grace. Why? Because if God gave his son for us, will he not with him, that is in Christ, freely give us all things? In other words, he's simply saying, don't be afraid to ask God, because God is the God who delights in answering prayer and giving. You see. So, if you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, and God will give him the wisdom, that is, the wisdom that he needs to joyfully approach manifold temptations and trials and heartaches. Now, in the Bible, this doctrine of wisdom is not a divinely given piece of information. It's a divine wisdom that God gives us in knowing how to use that which we already know. This is what wisdom is. The difference between wisdom and knowledge is that wisdom is the proper use of what we already know. And I said this before, I'm going to say it again here. You need to hear it again. That if we are failing in the Christian life, and in those areas that we're failing, usually it's not because we do not know what's right or know what to do. Usually it's the wisdom that what we require is the courage to apply it, and the wisdom to take that which we already know and bring that which we know to focus and to bear upon the problem and how to act. And if you've never had to really deal with problems in the spiritual realm, see, anybody can get mad. And when things go bad, or somebody dies, or they're sick, or you're sick, or things fall apart in other ways, it takes wisdom to sit down and say, now, how am I going to view this? How am I going to handle this? How am I going to get a hold of this and use it for my own good according to the will of God? It takes wisdom, doesn't it? You don't always know what to do. Very frankly, I've come to the place many times in the ministry, and this is not true confession day, but I'll tell you that the ministry has its problems. It's like your life has its problems. We all have different kinds of problems. And then in the ministry, very frankly, sometimes you just have to sit down and say, you just don't know what to do. And we see the need, as James says, to ask for wisdom. But he says, and this is the last point we're making this morning, if he asks, let him not ask wavering. Let him ask in faith, without any doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. You see, the picture of a man who doubts, he's like this, he's like a, you ever been to the seashore? The waves go, and they go up the shore and down the shore, in and out, driven by the wind. Where the wind's blowing, that's where they're going. And a man who doubts is like this. And do not let that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. He's Mr. Facing Both Ways, you know, Mr. Yes and No. Now, this, when he says ask in faith, he's not talking about some Christian Science brand of mental gymnastics. That is, you know, that you've got pain and difficulty and suffering, but if you just think about it right, it'll go away, you see. And if you admit the suffering, you're admitting to the presence of evil, and that's delusion. You know, and it's not the faith of the faith healer. So I heard a preacher here in town talking about on the radio last week. He was talking about a healing meeting they were going to have. And he says, if you've got people who are sick, bring them in and trust that the Lord's going to heal them. He said, even if you have to take them home in the same shape that you brought them, or trust that the Lord has healed them. Now, that's a lot of baloney. You know, you don't see the Lord doing this. The Lord never asked anybody to affirm that they had been healed or to rejoice in their healing until they were healed. That makes sense, doesn't it? And so, you know, you can see some poor guy stumbling out on crutches, and this fellow telling him, now, you're healed, you just don't know it. I'll tell you, that's not what he's talking about. This, let him not ask doubting. This word faith, we understand in the light of the whole doctrine of faith in the book of James. And in the book of James, the doctrine of faith is this resolute, unwavering determination to be God's man. You see that? Let him ask in faith, not wavering. What does that mean? That means that if you are facing temptations and you ask God for the wisdom that you need to use this temptation right, if you ask God to give you the wisdom that you need to handle this situation in such a way that the result will be that you will grow in your maturity and in your endurance, then you better mean business with God. Because listen, sometimes the wisdom of God leads us to do those things which are very difficult to do. And it's going to take a resolute mind. That is, God does not...